This episode is made possible thanks to listeners like you. Want to support independent food radio? Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today.
Good morning. Thank you for that symphony finishing, Patrick and Nate. Today is Thursday, July 18th. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here with my co-host, Patrick Martins.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime, anytime. We also have Eric Koss, our regular guest co-host of the Alameda Sun on the line from California.
Greetings.
Greetings, Earthling. Greetings.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Our guests for the Weekly Grill are Will Edwards, Nate Adler, and Katie Moore of Gertie Restaurant here in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Who's running the show right now? Or who's running the kitchen if you guys are all here?
There's this guy named Amir.
Just a guy?
Yeah, seriously. No joke.
So he's like receiving, cooking the eggs, making the corn muffins,
yeah, and my
brewing the cold brew.
My whole fiance's family is there right now, so we have no idea what's happening.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Are you letting them just like take over? They're having a dance party?
Dance party.
They're cooking their own food.
Awesome. That's what happens. Ownership, GMs, everybody goes away, have a dance party. Well, thanks for being with us, guys. Yeah. We hope that the place is intact when you get back. It's not our fault if it's not. So, first question of the day. What's your kebab? We got a press release from Layla's Lebanese, a restaurant marketing their kebabs and spice mixtures. We can't say we've tried them or ever heard of Layla's Lebanese, but we know we love a good kebab. What is your kebab of choice?
Hey, wait, where's the sound effect, Jeet? This is where we have our backdrop music. This is the round robin question of the Weekly Based.
Okay.
We didn't announce it was the Weekly Based.
I'm sorry. It is the Weekly Based. Thank you, Jeet, for being on your
round
toes.
Round robin question.
What
Think fast.
Is your kebab of choice?
Lamb.
Yeah, spicy lamb on a stick, obviously.
But did you grow up eating that? What has been your kebab? Like, what is your basically diced meat dish? Were you a Sloppy Joe person? Were you a hamburger? Like,
definitely what? Sloppy Joe. I grew up in Tennessee, so there was a lot of slap together quick after work, after school meals. So.
Do Tennesseans call Sloppy Joe's kebabs?
No,
I'm just saying
it is
chopped up meat. It doesn't have to be the same meat each time. You know what I mean? It doesn't. It's just cubes.
I'm confused as to why Sloppy Joe's and kebabs are related.
Minced meat, ground meat. That was where Patrick was going with this one.
But kebabs are usually, at least in my childhood, like chopped pieces of meat.
All right.
Yeah.
That are stacked in usually with like a grill, like onions, peppers.
Exactly.
Each culture has its mixed meat leftover or something you make in batch. The Sloppy Joe is an American one. I think the meatloaf is a kind of kebab for a lot of people. It's the thing you would eat three or four times a week.
I'm going to go with the hard veto. Meatloaf is not a kebab.
It's the form of a leftover meat potpourri. It could be all shoulder. It could be all this. I mean, do you see what I mean? Every culture has their own version of the thing you eat 3 days a week.
I propose something. The Sunday evening Gertie special is a meatloaf kebab.
On a sloppy joe.
Considering we just added a menu item, kebabs, exclamation point.
Did you?
Yeah, this is pretty
oh my gosh, tell us. Okay, so tell us about what
Will
is that?
Will could tell you
Will,
about that.
Chef Will, what is that kebab?
We change it up. It's a way to get seafood on the menu. And right now we're doing shrimp, spicy shrimp, and then just seasonal vegetables. So like sugar snap peas, cherry tomatoes. And then Katie makes this like sweet chili sauce with roasted garlic, which is
awesome.
On anything,
so the exact opposite form of kebab that Patrick is thinking of. There is nothing minced, but it is nice.
That's my kebab.
What's the ingredient in the kebab?
Right there.
What's the ingredient?
What does kebab mean? Anybody know?
There's no ingredient. It's just squared meat. Shoulder and leg do the best job of it. But if it's any squared meat, you could get a shank piece in a kebab. I mean, as long as it's not that different. Maybe that's a little bit too much.
The definition of a kebab, a dish of pieces of meat, fish, or vegetables roasted or grilled on a skewer or spit.
So the national dish does not have a primary ingredient other than the livestock. So that's the sign. That's what I was thinking.
Or is the stick is the main ingredient? Maybe.
I think you're right. I think it is right.
That's the
stick.
The common ingredient.
The stick is the common denominator. And what do you put on that stick?
So hot dogs.
Right?
Isn't that what Americans
like
say?
A corn dog. All right, so we've got a corn dog, we've got a sloppy Joe, we've got a, you said lamb, right, Nate?
I said lamb, but I'll take it back.
Okay, Chef Will?
I think I'd actually go potatoes, get them nice and charred.
Cut that part out, G.
Patrick?
I would
the
do,
meatloaf kebab?
I like lamb. I'm going to say this later in the show because the chance of it having been industrially raised in a commodity system on a factory farm is a lot less with lamb than it is with cows or pigs. Chickens. I mean, if you don't know where your chicken is coming from, does not healthy. It's certainly not any healthier than red meat from a good farm.
Gee, what's your kebab of choice?
Just chicken, I guess.
Chicken?
Yeah, any kind of chicken.
All right. There you go, Patrick. He's going to be diseased. He's eating bad chickens. All right. Yes. Mine, cubes of cheese. Does that count?
You love cheese.
I figured
Jesus
I'd give you that
Christ.
One. No, I like the shrimp one. I'm going to come in for this new shrimp menu item.
Try to weave in cheese into the next question.
I'm going to work on it right now. People are calling Gordon Ramsay's show Uncharted by National Geographic a ripoff of Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown.
I thought they called it cheesy.
They do. It's a cheesy ripoff. While others are saying he is the perfect replacement for Bourdain. What do you guys think? Ramsay versus Bourdain? Can Bourdain even be replaced? Nate is giving us like squinted eyes, frustration.
Gordon Ramsay is like my least favorite television food person ever.
I wrote him off back with Hell's Kitchen, where it was
too.
Just the flames that would come out. Like all the producers did on that show, or the editors, was just they put flames in front of everything.
I don't know
and
how
he
you,
was screaming.
I don't know how you go from that to like intellectual food media. Doesn't make sense to me.
Well,
I think I'd put Ramsay above Guy Fieri at least.
Oh, for sure.
But I don't know. Ramsay's just—it's all about entertainment. It's all about ratings. He's not actually like producing anything. Interesting.
It's like the Disney of food or something. Yeah.
Well, this is what Ann and I say. Can Bourdain be replaced by Ramsay? No. Bourdain was like a weirdo rock star. Ramsay is like an angry Brit. A one-track pony.
He does have a crappy attitude.
He has one tone, which is anger. I mean, that's not nuanced enough to be Bourdain.
Maybe he's had some media training, and they've said, look, if you're going to go around the country and you're going to, you know, meet with important or humble people, you need to soften a little. It premieres, I think I read, July 21st. So
what network?
They should
National
put
Geographic.
Jezre out there. Jezre would be good.
Is that a channel that people have?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I don't know. I will not be watching.
Also you will not be watching.
Also known as Nat Geo.
Yeah,
for sure.
Do you like that because your name is Nate? Do you?
I don't like when people get my name confused with Nat.
I don't know who would ever cut off the E at the end.
Yeah, I don't know why you do that. I know a Nat. I like the guy a lot, but Nate just feels better to me.
So in other news, today, July 18th, is National Caviar Day. And we're going to see if we can get our representative from Petrosian, Kyle Bernstein, on the line.
Happy National Caviar Day, everybody. We are going to be eating here some of the bottom of the barrel of caviar.
We have brought you the lowest of the low. No, just kidding.
But they turn it into cubes. And, it's something they would not sell as whole eggs because it comes from the end
of
the barrel.
Too fishy for you, Nate?
Wow.
I think it's quite mild, actually, compared to some caviar.
This is Maviar.
So this one's called Maviar, and this one we've sort of likened to being like a bacon bits.
Just grab some with your finger.
There's more spoons in there.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting.
So this one is more in like the bacon bits kind of family. It's called Florida Maviar, and it is dry-cured cod roe. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting, almost more like a finishing salt.
Yeah, exactly. Like on it is like bacon bits.
Yeah.
Chefs, do you like caviar?
Potato.
I mean, is that like a delicacy?
Oh, is that Kyle?
Hi, this is Kyle Bernstein.
Hey, Kyle. You have Emily and Patrick from Heritage Foods and Heritage Radio Network. We are celebrating National Caviar Day.
Happy National Caviar Day.
Hi, everybody. Happy caviar.
So what does this mean? Why is National Caviar Day important?
So this is a day that's designated by the American Supermarket Association. So they pick a day in July when there's no other national days going on, and they celebrate caviar because it's not a time of year when people are typically buying caviar. Mm-hmm. So it's a good time to raise awareness of, you know, where you can find caviar and why you should enjoy it.
So you've dedicated your life to promoting the world's best caviar. You work with the world's most prestigious caviar company, right? Petrosian.
I do.
Which goes back almost a century in France.
So, 1920.
Yeah. So why did you get into caviar? I mean, describe that life. Describe what fascinates you, what still turns you on about caviar after all these years.
So I was cooking professionally, and I love food, but I do not love the repetitive action of standing in a kitchen doing the same thing day after day. And I enjoy different kinds of food, particularly the kind of food that people don't know a lot about. And when I had this opportunity to start selling caviar, I felt like this was a good way for me to be a champion for something. And I didn't know a whole lot about caviar at the time, but I knew that I liked it, so I could learn to like it even more, and I could learn to teach other people how to enjoy it as much as I did.
And how do you describe it? It's a delicacy, right? I mean, are people wanting delicacies? Do Americans still understand that you have to invest to get the best of them? I mean, what's the state of delicacies and caviar here in the States?
So honestly, it does depend on who you are, where you grew up, what you grew up eating. For a lot of people, particularly Russians, they grew up eating caviar. So even though they live here, it's not a delicacy to them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting.
But, you know, it's a luxury good. It's also a food. So that makes it an interesting product for me. I like the fact that it's something unusual that people don't eat every day. And it's something that's best served as a special treat in small amounts. So it's not something you're going to have every day. But there's so much of it out there that you can try a different kind every time.
We're having a little Florida Maviar here, and those, what are the cubes called, Patrick? The
caviar cubes
with our chefs that are in studio with us here today. We're having a little for breakfast just in honor of the supermarket designation that it's National Caviar Day.
Well, I'm so happy
you
called.
Do you have some martinis to go with the caviar cubes?
Martini.
That's how I like mine.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to get some now during the break. But I do have one last question before we let you go. But thank you so much. Petrosian is historical. You're such a great spokesperson for this fish. Can you tell me if we buy an Ocetra caviar, what is the history of that? Like, that goes back 5 or 7 years, right? That fish started that process 5 or 7 years before I get it, right? If I buy it.
In a farmed situation, it does. Mm-hmm. In the wild, it could be 10 years.
Wow.
But it starts out as a little baby fish, and then they let it grow for a couple of years before they can determine the sex of the fish. And then they separate the males from the females, and the males go off to be used as meat and other things. And then the females get to swim and have great lives with their sisters and swim in the water and eat lots of food until they're ready to produce caviar 6 to 8 years later.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for calling in, and we are scheduling you to come in full person to person here in studio when you get back from National Caviar Day in the
following
weeks.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Have
a great day. Of course. You too. You too.
Thank you.
So,
hey guys.
Hey, yes, Eric.
I have it on good authority that this is also National Sour Candy Day.
Oh yeah.
I don't mean to mess with things. Not trying to ruin the show or anything.
I know we should. We should have paired a caviar cube with some Sour Patch Kids.
I wonder what the most expensive sour candy is of all time.
I really wish I hadn't eaten that. The caviar cube.
Right. Yeah.
The caviar cube is a little overwhelming.
Yeah, well, I think we should have mixed some martinis beforehand, she said.
On that note, though, what is the most unpalatable thing that you've ever eaten? Because I had a recent
You mean memory, like 2 minutes ago?
No. Are you talking about like just earlier in the show?
Yeah, just like 10 minutes ago. But no, seriously, I just took a trip and had something. So I wanted to hear
was this
you guys,
in the
though.
Dominican
That's a really
Republic?
Good question.
Where is it in
it was
the
in
DR?
France. Okay.
It wasn't in the DR. It wasn't that little container of alcohol.
Cheap
you drink.
Alcohol. By no. the way, there, you know what was on the cover of the New York Times? I know, Emily, you read it every time. Maybe I'll bring this up later, but
You're
Notre
gonna
Dame.
You're going to throw me under the bus right now.
No, Notre Dame was on the cover of the Times. It almost collapsed.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Well, anyway, sorry to interrupt. But
speaking of France.
But Patrick, I
okay,
really
no, this is a good question.
You.
Most disgusting food.
Like something that you were like, took a bite of and like, I don't want to eat this ever again.
I think my palate is so prostituted itself as just that nothing phases it. But as a child, I remember beets and Brussels sprouts like blowing my system so much that I would like vomit. Or now, I mean, what's going to get me? Hot sauce? Nothing. I mean, it's like,
no,
yeah. Like,
no, no. But I mean, mine like, probably, sorry, Kyle, if you're listening to this episode, mine is probably something in the like caviar cube family. For me, anything that's so fishy, I also have a little bit of trouble with liver.
Right.
Liver
yeah,
that's sort of been like
for me.
Oh, really?
Oh really? What about kidneys?
Yeah, sorry.
I don't know that
kidneys
I've,
are rough too. I don't know that I could eat those.
I've had chicken hearts. I don't know if I've ever
chicken
had kidneys.
Chicken hearts are good, though.
I mean, just like you know,
went to a restaurant in Paris that's famous for veal brain, and decided upon you know bad judgment to try this dish out. Thinking like maybe it was going to be charred or fried or something that could, you know, mask the texture of it. And it was literally like boiled veal brain that came out looking like a brain in broth. And people like,
wow,
love this dish. So I'm like, I'm at this restaurant. I have to try it. I took one bite and I was just like, nope, never again.
Perhaps if it was sprinkled with Maviar, it would
have been. Yeah, it needed a little bit of Maviar
well,
you've
bits. You got balls in your brain. I mean, that's impressive.
I mean, yeah. I, but when you're at a place that's famous for something, you do feel that you're supposed to try it.
Uh-huh. Like the 100-year eggs and stuff like that, at the Ear Inn and stuff like
that. Where's that? Like that?
Spring Street. So last Saturday was the women's, we're talking about worst taste. Now we're going to go to best taste. Last Saturday was the women's championship match at Wimbledon, where Serena Williams was defeated in straight sets by Simona Halep of Romania. Our top listener from across the pond, even though she's not a listener, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, was in attendance. If you are in charge of catering for Wimbledon, what amuse-bouche would you choose to make for the Duchess?
I feel like Meghan Markle must be an avocado toast lady, no?
She okay. might be. Yeah.
So you're going with avocado toast. It is the color of grass, the Perfect. Cover of Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Nice choice.
Eric, you got one?
I'm bringing her an In-N-Out burger from California, you know. So I have a feeling she's getting a little tired of these fancy dinners and these amuse-bouches and stuff. I think she's just going to want to go for an old-fashioned American fast food burger.
And when she looks at you in shock, you'll be like, do you feel like you've been treated unfairly?
Well, we'll just see. I think she's still got that American core to her.
She's actually Canadian, but yes.
Would you serve it still in its wrapping?
Oops.
No.
Well, No. Probably unwrapped on a silver platter just to, you know. Bring it up a notch.
I was asking my girlfriend, because she covers a lot of celebrities, what she might like, and she said that she's breastfeeding right now, so she's going to be really hungry. So I don't think it really matters.
She's just going to take it all to the face.
So you've taken it down a notch from hamburger, from fast food.
So basically, she'd like some breast milk.
Breast milk cheese. I would do turkeys on skewers. I didn't even think about the skewer thing earlier, but that's a turkey. It's the American food.
Yeah. But she's not American.
No, in honor of Serena Williams, I guess. Although Simona Halep
Meghan
won.
Meghan Markle is American.
She's Canadian. All right, I'm taking to the really Google here.
Canadian? No, I think they filmed her show in Montreal.
Like,
is that where I got it wrong? Hold on, let's check.
I think she grew up in Southern California.
I do not. Hold on.
Anyway, so
pigs in a blanket.
What would you?
You're right. She was born and raised in L.A. Correction, please.
She's
roll
been
the tape
to
back.
Canada.
I was like, am I in an alternate universe?
You were in an alternate universe for a minute.
Okay,
I have a
good.
Little cold.
All
I'm
right,
sorry. LA, you're right. Her show was filmed in Canada.
And you know across the pond is England, yes, not Canada. There's no water that separates us.
Just across the border, just across that wall.
What would you serve
fence.
Her?
Pizza.
Pizza?
Mm-hmm. Small bite. Nice. Nothing messy. Nothing to stain her skirt, or they look so beautiful. She was sitting with her sister-in-law, Kate Middleton, and Pippa. She's got to remain very, you know, no napkin, just single bite.
She dressed in black for one of her two appearances there, which was a statement.
She only at the women's final or the men's final too?
I did not get to watch the men's. Was she there?
And the men's final was epic.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oof. Six sets.
On Sunday morning, I chose to go to the gym, and I happened to have missed the match.
Yeah, no, you can still rewatch it. Yeah. So, Eric, you brought up one that you wanted to cover about whiskey. Tell us about this story and why it's important, or what your thought is.
Well, I saw this covered on the news, but I thought it was kind of a fascinating thing that there is this brand of whiskey out there called Uncle Nearest. And it's apparently it honors this former slave that taught Jack Daniel how to make whiskey. Only the greatest Tennessee whiskey kind of guy. And so Uncle Nearest is actually named for this guy, Nathan Green, who's supposedly the first African-American distiller on record. And he's known for creating, or at least sort of like setting down this thing called the Lincoln County process. And I don't know, maybe one of you guys said you were from Tennessee. I don't know, maybe you could tell us more about this.
That's Katie here.
Yeah, Katie, that was a long-held secret in Lincoln County that this slave and Jack Daniels kind of like teamed up early on to set up this Lincoln County process. And they were kind of like friends.
I've never heard this cool story before.
Cool. Yeah.
Did Eric just make it up? It's not Tennessee.
It's not Tennessee folklore.
Seems like something it's Tennessee coming out now.
So, are there any reparations? Has his family seen any of the profits?
Well, I think there's the CEO of the company is an African American lady named Fawn Weaver, who is supposedly the first minority and female owner of a craft spirits company or some distinction like that. And she took like an old horse farm and converted it to this whiskey distillery specifically to bring attention to this family, the Green family, or I guess, you know, his nickname was Nearest or something like this. So
we're going to have to get some of this to add to our bar here in the studio.
You know,
well, when I read this story of yours, it brings up this idea of reparations, which we shouldn't get into here. But, you know, there's a food story of some, you know, black person not getting, you know, anything of gazillions of dollars of profits, even though they might have founded the place. You know what I mean? And is that company, the big one, going to do anything to either buy that one or be generous to them or help them? I don't know. You know, it's just we forget. That's a founder. You can't deny a founding father.
But. Right. And it appears that the Jack Daniel's company is being very friendly with this other company and, like, supporting them and kind of like just in like it was in the old days. I guess they were friends, and so the two companies are going to be friends and share their story.
I might have missed you. You might have said this. Is this distillery also in Tennessee, like nearby now?
Yeah, I believe so. I was clicking around on some of it, but I don't have the precise location. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we can Google it.
A lot of the whiskey distilleries in Tennessee are located in dry counties, so when you go and like go on tours, you can't actually taste anything. They like send you to the next town to like go.
So they have to have like, do they have a separate tasting room, or do they send you to like a liquor store that they say, oh, this is our partner in the other county?
They send you to like a bar that they know has things, but they like let you smell it. They'll waft whiskey in your direction.
You just get a like slight, you know, a little buzz from
secondhand
the waft.
Buzz.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A little contact high, and then you go on your way to the bar.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, we'll have to get some to add to our bar in the studio.
It says near Lynchburg.
Oh, yeah, that's where Jack Daniels is, so it must be like
that name
neighbors.
Sounds They should change that name.
Yeah.
Lynchburg.
But all the Jack Daniels, I've been a
That's
couple
another
times.
One, yeah.
All the Jack Daniels in the entire world is brewed in this one distillery in Lynchburg.
How do you feel about the taking down of Southern traditions? We always ask people from the South this question, and they've all answered the same way so far the three times we've asked. But how do you feel?
Like statues?
Taking down statues.
I think it's great.
Okay.
Yeah. Do other people say the same, or is it...
Basically, I think the consensus that they would all agree to, that they kind of said or came to, is that they would like at least a museum to house these, and people can visit and learn about history.
Basically,
but don't
to
take
not
it away.
To not erase history,
right.
Just
but
to
not glorify it.
Just to not glorify it, to still have this educational experience, to put them somewhere and preserve it so that it's still part of something you can learn about, whether it's for good or bad. Mm-hmm. But you know, that they could be removed and relocated.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think that was the politically correct answer, too. To
bonfire
be said
that, yeah. That they were
well
trying
said.
To answer.
Exactly. Well. In terms of some other products that we don't have our hands on, because apparently Bushwick is not supporting rosé season. Rosé season is in full swing, and we read that Driscoll's now has limited edition rosé-flavored strawberries and raspberries. They were developed by Driscoll's own team of breeders, sensory analysts, plant health scientists, and entomologists who breed different varieties of berries, supposedly without the use of GMOs. According to a description on Driscoll's website, the berries come in a blush color that resembles the light pink wine, and they contain sweet peachy notes capped off with a soft floral finish to mimic the taste of rosé, but without the alcohol. I did try to buy some for us.
Love it.
Bushwick really let me down. Loves it.
Really cool.
Loves it.
Are you going to have them this weekend?
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, they do that stuff with all the fruits and vegetables anyway, so who cares? Make it a nice looking color. I mean, I doubt it affects the taste, but...
They're claiming that it has a rosé...
Because of a color?
I don't even know what that means.
Rosé. It means peachy notes capped off with a soft floral finish.
Where can you buy these things?
Supposedly around. I don't know, but Bushwick's food story in Brooklyn Natural did not have them.
Hmm.
So we will have to go to Manhattan, I think. For
what do you guys think about
online?
Sounds like non-alcoholic beer to me, and I'd rather just have the real stuff.
All right.
How important are things looking nice for your very successful restaurant?
I mean, we don't want things really that are like super bruised or rotten, but we're also not going to just throw stuff away because it doesn't look perfect.
I saw that there was a thing on Eater today, which I read like maybe once a month, but they said the New York's best cookie is going around. And I said, you know, going around the rest of the country, and it looks so ugly. It was just
which cookie
Levain.
Is it?
I saw it.
Levain.
Sorry,
you were just in France.
I'm in France. Grew up on those cookies, didn't you?
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah, Will did too.
They are they're originally doughy. Upper West Side, 74th in Amsterdam, I
Levain,
believe it is.
Levain, tomato, Levain. Tomato, but no one says potato. There's tomato, tomato.
Did
I
anyone
guess.
In
potato,
France say
yes.
potato?
Potato?
Do people say tomato?
Some weird people. There's a contingent.
They say pomme de terre.
Pomme
de terre, right. That's like what they say.
What is that, apple of the earth?
So what do you think about this issue? Driscoll.
Well, I was going to go back to the cookie for a second, just to say that I am a crispy cookie person, but there is something about the Levain cookie, which is more scone-like, mm-hmm. but it's just like gooey, and the right edges
How
have a little crisp. They're very expensive.
Cookie experts.
And they weigh a lot in your stomach.
Katie and Will, how much butter do you think is in the Levain cookie?
I'm not familiar with it. Is it like a chocolate chip situation? Or?
They have four different flavors. The chocolate chip actually also has walnuts. You cannot get like a pure chocolate chip. They do a chocolate chip. And they're like this big, for those who can see on TV right now.
So
they're
thick.
Like donut size, and they look more like a scone.
I would say a large amount of butter.
Yeah, they're...
As there should be.
As there should be, yeah. You guys do all of your pastries in-house. Can you tell us a little bit about that program at Gertie?
We have a woman named Savannah who does all of our bread and pastries every morning. We have a chocolate chip cookie. I would say it's one of the best in New York. I don't know.
Whoa.
Does it have a lot
of
butter?
It does. It's more of a chewy cookie, so it might not be up your alley, Emily.
Okay.
But you have to come and try it.
I'm going to preface this next statement with you're welcome for giving you this idea. We have no listeners, so you're actually the only one listening to this idea. I'm not really spreading it around. No, I'm just kidding. Rum raisin. a flavor for ice cream and cookies. That chocolate, you know, or rum raisin could somehow.
I like oatmeal raisin. Can you make like an oatmeal rum raisin?
I have a good idea.
No one makes rum raisin anything
anymore.
You
could make the cookies and then put the leftover cookies into ice cream.
Yeah.
And then put some rosé flavored raspberries on top.
It's like a whole animal.
Okay, we could just do a lot of things here. We could take the rosé raspberries and we can make an Italian ice like we do at Gertie. Right now, it's strawberry Italian ice. Then we mix it with ice cream. We also have this thing called cookies and cream where we take our cookies, like Oreo cookies, and dice them up and mix them up with ice cream. So we could do that with rum raisin just for Patrick.
And then do one rosé. I think rosé raspberry. It does sound expensive. I did not get a price quote on these current limited edition Driscoll rosé berries.
Well, one thing, you'd never see the Driscoll raspberries at a diner. So this month marks the 30th anniversary of the premiere of Seinfeld, which has us thinking about Tom's Restaurant, their famous coffee shop.
Upper West Side.
We have so many Seinfeld references at Gertie, it's insane.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what's your go-to diner food, or what story do you have about Seinfeld's 30th, the diner, anything you've ever thought about Seinfeld? I grew up going to a coffee shop called Nectar on 79th and Madison. That's how I knew Reggie Jackson. The owner was named George Kirkostas, and
very close to George Costanza.
Yes.
Okay.
He was working the grill. Then he opened another Nectar 2, which is on 81st, right by the Met. It's basically the coffee shop to the Metropolitan Museum. It has the most insanely expensive cheeseburger I've ever seen. It's like, you know, a fancy restaurant.
So price. Is that the Upper East Side's version of Tom's?
Well, no, I'm just saying coffee shop.
So for those listeners who don't know what this is, it's a diner that just says restaurant in big letters on the outside. And that was the outside shot for Seinfeld's,
Tom's,
you know,
restaurant.
Yeah. Did it say Tom's on the outside?
Yeah. And
I thought it just said restaurant.
And it said Tom's restaurant. And believe it or not, so I grew up 4 blocks from Tom's restaurant, and I never went.
You never went.
Because there were better diners. It was just a facade.
Go figure.
I used to go and visit my brother when he was at Columbia. We'd go at like 3 in the morning. And
what was your go-to order?
I'm sorry, Tom's. Nothing's particularly memorable, but, you know, like
so what's your go-to diner food? Hash browns?
I would say like hash browns, patty melt situation. But, I mean, in the South, the diners are a little different. I would say people treat Waffle House like a diner. And it's all breakfast all the time.
Your diners have like Edward's ham and Nancy Newsom's ham and Benton's ham. That's a real bastion for those producers.
Steak.
Yeah. I get chicken souvlaki always because they make good tzatziki. It's like a mayonnaise thing. I ask for lamb if they have it. And the cheeseburger.
What's the deal with you and
Mediterranean?
Kebabs.
Oh, kebabs.
And like Mediterranean.
I keep bringing
stuff.
This up. Yeah. Maybe it's the stick, the skewer.
Do
I
you ever
know.
Go to Big Nick's?
No.
That's a greasy
Nick's.
Burger.
Was like the diner of choice for Upper West Side kids. They were open 24 hours a day, and they had the largest menu on the history of the planet. They had like 70 different types of hamburgers with like, instead of saying we have these toppings, you can do a hamburger with any of these toppings. It was like, we're going to pair them all together and give them ridiculous names. So that's what they did.
It was
so
truly
when you say
greasy.
It was popular with kids, what happens is the check is dropped, all the kids put in what they think they owe, and you're like $280 short.
That's usually how it works in high school.
Or more likely, they were coming from Riverside Park or something and needed to have something to eat after illicit things.
Illicit drugs.
My favorite part about Big Nick's was also not just the burgers, but they had the sumo burger, which was 1 pound patty, and whenever we would go, try to convince one person, be like, oh, you should totally get it, you're gonna love it, and that guy gets there and sits there for half an hour trying to eat it, and then that's when we all skip out on the bill, and that guy
he got sniped.
That's how it goes on the Upper West Side.
The bacon, egg, and cheese, they must be the beginning of the bacon, egg, and cheese, which is a go-to breakfast, I think, more in New York, but maybe around the
how
country.
About just the buttered roll? That's a very New York. That's more of a street
you get
cart
breakfast
thing.
For 70
totally
cents.
New York thing.
I know. I think it's a real New York thing.
Gertie's
the butter roll.
Inspired by diner.
Yeah.
You know, luncheonette is what we call it, and a lot of our menu I think is inspired by the diner. So, the griddled muffins with butter and jam. No one does it.
Except at home.
It's the best thing in the world.
Like the bodega.
Yeah. Bacon, egg, and cheese. I think is definitely a diner thing, but also corner deli for sure.
Yes.
And then, you know, we got the patty melt. My big diner thing was the tuna melt.
Yeah, no, that's
love
good.
A diner tuna.
And what's your
chicken
number?
Chicken salad.
What's
if
your
I were
number?
You, I would get a little souvlaki stand, like tiny and contained off in the corner.
They do have a beautiful rotisserie at Gerti, but you could have one right now. You could have a little kebab.
Do you know the best
situation.
Meat they served at the coffee shop, highest quality, was an entire. It was either a brisket or a turkey. It switched each day, but there were only five
That's
or seven
That's what they
choices.
Want you to think. How do you know that was the highest quality?
Because you see it there. It's the whole third 20-pound bird, and they cut off the turkey. It's like the fresh roast that they're carving
it's
off.
It's just sitting out all day?
It's just sitting out in total ambient temperature.
Oh, my gosh. You know, what's your Seinfeld reference? You said you have a bunch.
My favorite Seinfeld reference from that. From that diner is when I think it's like a Bizarro George episode where he decides to like do everything the opposite of what he normally does.
Yeah.
And so he walks.
He gets the
right
job
up
at the
to
Yankees.
Some lady at the counter. Yeah. Right. Well, is that what it is? Oh yeah, that same episode. He gets the job at the Yankees, mm-hmm. but he in the diner he approaches this lady out of the blue and he goes, "Hi, my name is George. I'm unemployed and I live with my parents." And she goes, "Hi, George.
Yeah.
So nice to meet you." Like, everything just starts breaking his way because he does everything the opposite of what he usually does, which is lie.
And then the funniest thing is he did later in the show say something totally stupid. And Jerry says, "Was that opposite George or was that real George?" Because it should have been opposite George.
Yeah.
That was a great show,
that was
man.
Good episode.
We, yep. I mean, am I allowed to say that we sent them a big meat box as a gift? Someone bought
Go
a huge
it.
Meat box with us. I will not give the address and the apartment number, but I will say that we did give the a big box. It was cool to see the Seinfelds. And I think she was approached about interning with us. I don't think we were selected, but I think we were at the bottom of the list for their daughter to possibly intern at. That would have been great.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. If she ever comes around, we'll send her to Gerti so you can tell her all the Seinfeld
yeah, there,
references.
There are two.
Okay.
One is The Big Salad,
okay.
which is an awesome episode if you haven't seen that.
Does he get rejected to the second lesser diner in that one at the very end? George is eating alone at the shitty diner.
I think so. I think it's when Elaine makes all these friends in her bizarro world.
Uh-huh.
And they go to the bizarro diner and she just wants the big salad.
Yeah.
And they don't have it and she gets very upset.
I know. And what's the other one?
So the other one is Poppy's Duck, which is our rotisserie duck dinner. And that episode is amazing. Where
so you
I have
named
to watch
your
it.
Signature go-to dish after a guy who didn't wash his hands in the
yes,
bathroom after
exactly.
taking a shit. How is that going for you?
It sounds like it's going well. The rotisserie is
no
still
comment,
rolling.
No
Nothing says quality and cleanliness like Poppy, who also urinated on the couch in the lobby, remember?
I have to go rewatch a lot of these.
And on Jerry's couch.
He also has a weird political ideology, I think.
Yes, exactly.
About abortion. Yeah.
Great character. Yeah. You should have just called it the Soup Nazi instead of Gerti.
I like this. I like all your homage to Seinfeld that's like woven in versus the like Golden Girls restaurant. And then there was like, we talked on the show about the Max, the Saved by the Bell show that was opening in California.
The Golden Girl.
I think it works when you weave in legacy, you know, and you don't.
The Golden Girl, all they had was oatmeal. That was the only thing on the whole menu. But I will say, I think this is the most amount of New Yorkers we've ever had in studio, born and raised. One, two,
four.
Three, four.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I can leave with you.
No, yeah. Katie, could you just, we're going to take a picture at the end. We're all Upper West Side. You are outnumbered.
We would like to say some condescending things about the South, if you don't mind leaving for one second.
Yeah, I can join in.
Just kidding.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about Gerti and maybe the Upper West Side, just so Patrick feels left out.
Yeah.
All right, G, take us to break.
This episode is brought to you by you. As an independent member-supported nonprofit, the amazing content you hear on HRN is made possible thanks to our generous community of members and partners. For 10 years, HRN has been a defining voice in America's food movement, and we never would have made it this far without you. Join us in celebrating an amazing decade of food radio and support our summer fun drive by becoming a member of HRN. You can choose from our member gifts and will receive exclusive discounts on HRN events. We truly believe that with your help, we can change the world and our food system one bite or sound bite at a time. But there's no food radio without you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate before July 31st to do your part to ensure a bright future for your favorite food podcasts.
All right, we're back. We were just talking off the air about how long you have to live in New York to be considered a New Yorker.
Born and raised. It's like the mafia. You have to show three generations.
All right, I take it back, Katie. You cannot be an honorary New Yorker. I'm sorry.
I forgive you.
Okay, thank you. So, yeah, well, go for it.
Well, just don't, if you're from Westchester, don't say you're a New Yorker.
Oh, I know, I know.
Long Island's worse.
Yeah, I went to the University of Michigan for undergrad, and I started to get a little snippy with people who I would be like, oh, where's your roommate from? They're like, New York City. And I'm like, no, where are they actually from? And they're like, I don't know, this place called Westchester. They said New York City. And I'm like, that's not the same.
Why would
don't, they're trying to pull
that.
The wool over your eyes.
But like, what is appealing about lying about that?
I don't know. Especially when then people say New Yorkers are rude and that like we're bad
very
people.
Nice. No,
I
think born and raised are very yeah, nice. It's people who move here from other places who act, who change the way they
so,
act.
So we're the Main Course OG. If you're just tuning in, we are broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And
what's the date today? July
18th.
So we want to hear what's on the cover of the Alameda Sun before we go to the interview part.
Oh. Right on. Yeah, I got another one of these national stories happening locally. We had a little more than 100 Alamedans protesting the border issue at City Hall the other day. So we have like a nice photo and story with that.
Were there any arrests?
No, but, you know, they're holding up these signs that say close the camps, you know, hashtag close the camps. Down there at the border. So, you know, our people here are letting their voices be heard. I guess joining in a national protest last Friday.
Good for you.
Yeah. So there you go. That's on the front this week.
Well, I think there's this thing, and I was going to bring this up with the caviar. You know, everyone lives the mean, the even, all the time. They don't go high and low. I don't know, a good old-fashioned protest, I want to see someone get arrested. It could be some rich old single guy who's like, nope, then arrest me. And they're like, an arrest! And that's how you get energy. But we don't live like that, because you're like, oh, I got to pick up my grandson at 9 o'clock, and what about tomorrow? And that's also why people don't buy caviar. They're like, $200 for a meal? Sometimes they go out and spend $180. You know what I mean? It's like, you just live, you live the mean, not the extreme.
Oh, you're going to make a little tagline, put that on a shirt?
Well, good for them. I wish someone had gotten arrested, but...
So,
yeah, I know, but we support our protesters here.
As long as it's everybody's kept safe exactly. On the island of Alameda.
Protest from your house.
Exactly. So we're in studio with Nate Adler, Will Edwards, and Katie Moore of Gertie Restaurant. And so we've been talking all day dining quite a bit on this show. But tell us about Gertie and why it works.
Will?
I mean, the cool thing about Gertie is that the idea, our tagline is good food every day. So you can come in at 8:30 for a pastry breakfast sandwich, come in at 2 o'clock for a chicken salad sandwich or tuna melt, or you could come at night for rotisserie chicken. And sort of the idea is that we're that neighborhood restaurant and you don't really need to go online to see if we're open, or you don't need to call to make a reservation. You just know that you show up and you're going to find something that you like and you're going to have a good time.
And you guys have a full bar. So you really take it from morning to night.
My
so
advice, you weren't there. I came and I said, put the word cocktails bigger at the front too, because cocktail is a whole culture that opens you up to a whole new group of people that will eat your food because you have cocktails.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that it's interesting that you say it's working, because to an extent it is working. But what is difficult is exactly what Patrick said, which is, when you think about Gertie, do you think about it as a daytime spot with these beautiful floor-to-ceiling windows and this amazing mural and color and pastries and bread and all that good stuff and eggs? can you also like alter your mind to say, wow, they have an awesome cocktail program and they pour cocktails on draft, which is something that a lot of people don't do, and they have natural wine and craft beer. And how do you make those things coexist in the same space? It's a big challenge.
No, that's a challenge. I mean, I would do, you know, signage on the outside saying cocktail of the day, come try it later, or tasting, or a happy hour. I mean, yeah, you have to get around it because your place looks very pretty, like a French bistro. So it's hard to think that people are going to want to come and be three cocktails in, you know.
But your location is like super indoor, outdoor. You guys are able to open your windows. I think you do have the layout and the vibe for that, like, late afternoon cocktail, yeah, or drinking Bloody Marys in the morning.
We call it golden hour because it's like that homage to, you know, the 1950s kind of idea of drinking a dirty martini while the sun's setting. And the restaurant is named after my grandmother. So she was a very, despite not really drinking, actually, she was a very eccentric human being. And that sort of feels right to us, I think. In an ideal world for all of us, it'd be amazing to see it become a place where between 3 and 6, everyone's having a drink. And that's like, if you're a tourist, like I was just on vacation, I had a drink every day at lunch because you can.
You know, my mom was in town last weekend with a friend who's never been to New York, and they came straight to Gertie from LaGuardia at 10:30 and had a bacon, egg, and cheese and dirty martinis.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
that's the dopest move ever. I mean,
they have a little of the same challenges untitled. It's a very pretty glass open area. You almost feel like you're sitting outside. And yet, you know, how do you convince people to stop and eat and just like come in and have a drink? Because yeah, most people, that's what they want. Saturday afternoon, they're with their family. They go, they have a martini, and then they go to all the playgrounds with their grandkids and stuff like that. But
we'd love for everybody to have a 2-martini lunch.
Yeah, that would
sound ideal. I wish I could do that more.
Doesn't that suit the Williamsburg culture? You know, like work hard, play hard. Maybe work while you drink your martinis.
We have two regulars that are awesome, and they come in and get the big salad usually. And they drink a bottle of white wine.
That's great.
And it's amazing. And, you know, I couldn't do it, but more power to you.
But they go home and take a nap after.
No, they go back to work.
Wow.
Do you have a, don't give them a house account. Doesn't sound like that. Yeah. No, just kidding. But do you have house accounts?
Yeah.
That's the sign of a neighborhood place, is where you pay at the end of the month.
Well, we're trying to build. Oh, I see what you mean. We have a couple house accounts, but they're few and far between at the moment.
It used
but
to be me.
What you're
more
saying
when it
is,
was...
we could have one if we wanted one.
Patrick and Emily, any day of the week.
We've talked about this
house
on air.
House accounts meant more when banks were closed at 3 and there were no ATMs.
Okay, that's true.
And now it's so easy to pay.
When you let your 9-year-old walk down the street by himself to go a couple blocks to go pick up, you know, bread and eggs and whatever, and
right.
They weren't carrying cash or a credit card or an iPhone, and they were like, put it on Pearson, and then their parents would get the bill at the end
of
the month.
And then your phone number would be like Trafalgar 9 3712. That's what they still have at Gentile's Market, still has Trafalgar 9. I'm like, dude,
here's what we're
not even
do.
The old people remember that.
Since we know that Heritage is, you know, they're serving endangered species. What did you say?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Eat them to save them.
Eat them to save them. Really super profitable business. What we're going to do is we're going to make a house account for Heritage. We're going to tell everybody on Instagram.
Oh, shit.
Everyone's going to come in and be like, yeah, I'm going to put that on the Heritage account, please. And then at the end of the month, we're going to bill you.
I used to get in. I'll tell you one quick story about a fight I got with a coffee shop. So they'd have grilled cheese sandwiches at Jimbo's for $4.65 or $5.20, whatever it was. So I would always go and be like, could I just get a roll, please? They'd be like, that's 20 cents. I'm like, could you put a side of cheese on that, please? They're like, that's another 20 cents. I'm like, could you just throw that little puppy in the grill just for a second? Just before you give it. So they donated like 80 cents like 2 times in a row. And then finally they were like, $5.20. I'm like, fuck you. I don't know. Until I got banned. Swear to God.
Your photo's on the wall.
Well, no, I used to have to get burgers to Ronaldo's apartment next door. I'm like, you're accepting a delivery.
That's like the Seinfeld where Kramer has Jerry buy his fruit.
And also where the Chinese restaurant banned Elaine because she was on the other side of 86th
Street. Right, exactly.
I don't want to tell the greater Williamsburg population about this move, but this is exactly the Patrick move, but with bougie coffee. Uh-huh. So an espresso is $3, right? And do you know what an iced latte is? Usually 5, 5.56. Do you know what espresso an iced latte ice. Is? It's espresso over ice with a bunch of milk. So all you got to do...
Milk is free.
Milk okay. is on the counter, at least at Gertie. Yeah.
You know where you know where it's not welcomed? At Swallow, down the block. I ordered an espresso over ice because I don't like their iced coffee. And then I asked for milk. And she's like, that's not the same beverage.
Don't go there ever Ooh. Again.
I mean, I don't
go there. 2 years.
It. I used to do that all the time when I was in college at
I do it at Starbucks.
Can I get an espresso over ice? And I didn't realize I was like scheming at the beginning, actually.
I didn't either.
And then I realized like, whoa, an espresso is $2.50 and an iced coffee is $4. Cool.
Yeah, no, it's true.
So who are your mentors, chefs?
Will, you can take it away.
Is Will your mentor?
No, I'd actually say Katie is more my mentor. When we worked at Marlowe and Sons and Diner, Katie was running the show, and she whipped me into shape and sort of made me the person I am now. And along those lines, like the people in the Tarlow Empire, the chefs back when we were there, like Ken Wiss and Dave Gould, those guys really, I think, inspired us, or at least have inspired me, to sort of create Gertie and make it as good a place as I hope everyone thinks it is.
It's a great answer, Chef. Yeah,
I would agree with that. I mean, I essentially learned to cook at Diner with Ken Wiss and Nick Perkins, who owns Hearts and Servos and those restaurants. I didn't really know anything I was doing when I started there, and they kind of taught me everything and also taught me how to be a efficient manager, which I think is hard to learn. But it's been fun to, when we were at Diner, I was, for a minute at least, I was Will's boss, and now we flipped the script and it's working well so far.
We actually met that whole group through Christina Lecky at the White Hotel, who is not even part of his group anymore. Yeah. And yet it was enough when he owned it to introduce us to that restaurant group. So it's really nice to have the relationship with that team. What about you?
Yeah, so I come from the front of house side, the more business-y mentorship.
So you're going to say me, aren't you?
Patrick Martin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had the honor to work for Danny Meyer when I was right out of college. You know, you don't get a lot of one-on-one contact with a guy like that, but certainly as like a guy in the clouds, definitely inspirational. Andrew Tarlow is actually a really close mentor of mine. Was the first guy that I ever met in restaurants when I moved back to New York after college, and like gave me an hour of his time when I was 20 years old and had never worked in a restaurant before, and we're still quite close. And that's, there are a few other people.
Some people we ask this question and they don't have an answer. I mean, didn't one person answer Eric Koss, who they met for the first time via telephone?
Exactly. Like, how did you know?
Earlier. No, it's funny. Old people, like in their 50s, 60s, are like, oh my God, where do I begin? What are we talking about? Like, is it in the writing thing? And now young kids are like a mentor. I was thinking about that in politics too. We don't really have the Martin Luther Kings, the Kennedys, the people making great speeches that we're quoting and that our history teachers playing for us to listen to. No one's making those anymore. In the old days, we can quote 10 of the speeches, I Have a Dream, and we know Ich bin Berliner, you know, I am a Berliner when he went to Germany. I mean, these are all historic speeches.
But I do find when we have chefs on the show, especially, there is especially in a strong restaurant, in an environment that fosters like learning and being a supportive manager or a harsh manager, but still being a good one, that we find that a lot of chefs do have mentors and do have people who taught them mm-hmm. to be the owner or the line cook or whatever position it was.
What word perfectly summarizes the teaching from master to apprentice carried down through the ages? Terroir. The terroir of the brain.
Mm.
You know, there is. There's no term for that.
It sounds like Andrew Tarlow has
corporate knowledge.
Corporate knowledge, yeah. So what's next for Gertie? Anything that our listeners should know about? Are you opening another location? We know there's kebabs on the menu.
Kebabs. We'd like to, definitely. I think, you know, we're trying to... I think what's next for us in Williamsburg is really trying to dial in who we want to be long-term. You know, we've seen so much positive feedback and a lot of regular guests, and most of those regular guests are coming during the daytime. And so what do we want to be at night, and what do we want to be to the greater Williamsburg and New York and potentially beyond that community?
I hear open mic poetry slam in the future.
They do have a cool basement space.
There's a clown show on the calendar for next week.
Which
I still don't know what that means.
Miming lessons.
But you guys do have a cool space downstairs and a space out in the back. But I know that downstairs you can rent, correct me if I'm wrong, you can rent it out, and then you can order a la carte food and drinks and kind of like make it your own space.
Now, I don't want to tell you, Job, you're more experienced than me, but I am almost 50 years old. Stick with the poppy references. As much poppy as you can connect to the food. That's what you want.
Exactly. Thank you guys so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome anytime, and we're excited for our house account that's going to have a secret name so nobody knows.
It's going to be harder to write down the amount you owe us than you actually just giving me your card.
Yeah. I hear that.
Just do some meat trades.
Barter. Yes.
They do have you guys have quite a bit of heritage product on your menu. You use our maple sugar cure ham, bacon. You have some pork in the rotisserie, or did. Maybe that got bumped.
We have pork racks in the rotisserie, and we're also putting on a shoulder now. Probably in the next few days.
We're excited. We have to come eat up all the pork. Anyway, thanks for being with us. Next week, tune in. We have a few visitors from the North Fork of Long Island. We're going to talk and hopefully eat some oysters. And Ben Flanner from Brooklyn Grange.
Don't worry, not you, Eric. We won't send you one.
So we will see you guys next Thursday. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.